Are you familiar with the term thin places? Thin places? According to the ancient Celts, the early Christians of Scotland and Ireland, thin places are those locations where the boundary between heaven and earth is especially thin. Thin places are thought to be those spots in life where the divine is able to be sensed more readily than in other places. The island of Iona, the cliffs at St. David's, and the remains of St. Michael's Church at Glastonbury are just some of the thin places in Celtic lore. Today, places like Lourdes and Fatima have become thin places for many people. I have always liked the concept of thin places, and I believe that the religious sites in Europe are not the only places that you can find them. For Carol and me, the Shrine of the Holy Family just south of Gretna has become a thin place. Anybody ever been there? You need to go there. Just keep on going past the interstate, hang a right at the Flying J, and go down the road, and you'll find it. Perhaps it's special to us because it's one of the first places I ever took her when she first came to Omaha. How weird am I? But you know, as we sit there and overlook Interstate 80, heaven and earth seem to touch. The chapel of my home church is another place where I have seen heaven and earth touch. They are all very, very beautiful places. Yet one does not have to be in a churchy location in order to discover a thin place. Ordinary, everyday places can become thin places as well. There is a hill that overlooks the Platte Valley, just a short distance from my house, that has become a thin place for me. I discovered a thin place at my youngest son's wedding. And I have a feeling that the first time I get to hold my granddaughter, I will discover a thin place as well. According to this morning's lesson from Luke, the dinner table at an Emmaus home became a thin place for two broken-hearted disciples. How so? Well, if you give me a few moments, I'll try my best to explain. But before we do, I need to stop and tell you that if you are expecting some tear-jerking, syrupy sweet, M is for the many things she gave me Mother's Day sermon, then you're going to be very, very disappointed this morning. I don't do them. I learned a long, long time ago that the typical Mother's Day sermon can be very, very painful for many women. For a variety of reasons, they just don't ring true for everyone. One of the biggest reasons is because not all of us were blessed with great mothers. Not everyone has great memories of dear old mom. As I tell my daughter Ella all the time, any woman could become a mother, but only special women know how to become a mom. And by the way, the same thing happens for men. Any man can become a father. It's just an act of biology. But it takes special men to become dads or daddies. Another reason that Mother's Day sermons don't ring true for everyone is that not all women have had the opportunity to have children. The typical mom, dad, two kids in a dog lifestyle is simply not a part of their experience. For one reason or another, they never had kids. And some mushy Mother's Day sermon is just another opportunity for them to feel the guilt or the sorrow of that reality. Finally, I have a very personal reason that I don't preach Mother's Day sermons. My dad died on Mother's Day of 1983, which just so happened to fall on May 8th of that year, which, as you may know, is today's dates. While I love my mom dearly, it's very difficult for me to think only of her on this particular day, and I know that she and my brother and my sister all feel the same. That's why I'm glad that our United Methodist Church has de- decided to celebrate the Christian home on this particular day. A Christian home is not dependent upon whether or not someone has kids. A Christian home does not care if someone is single or married or married with children or divorced or an empty nester or widowed or whatever. A Christian home, as we shall see, can happen anywhere that heaven and earth tend to meet. And when it does, that place becomes a thin place. As I already mentioned, a lowly dinner table in a small town named Emmaus became a thin place for two broken-hearted disciples. We need to remember their story together. You heard me read it just a few moments ago. It was the afternoon of the very first Easter. A disciple named Cleopas and his companion, which many believe to be his wife, and tradition says that her name was Hannah, were traveling from Jerusalem to Emmaus, a brisk walk of about 7 miles. As they walked, they were discussing everything that had happened among their little band of friends over the past few days, the death, burial, and now the rather unbelievable story of the resurrection of their dear friend and teacher from Nazareth. Luke writes that at some point along the way, the now risen Jesus joined them and started making small talk. The two disciples, however, did not recognize that it was Jesus. We could spend the next hour or so trying to analyze why they did not recognize him, keeping with the adage that the simplest explanation is always the best. It is perfectly acceptable to say that they didn't recognize him because they simply weren't expecting him. Who would be? Recently deceased acquaintances usually don't make a habit of joining you on your afternoon walk. Well, as they walked, Jesus asked them what in the world they were talking about. They turned and looked at him in disbelief. You don't read the newspaper or check your BlackBerry? Are you that out of the loop? We're talking about the crucifixion of Jesus, of course. I imagine that Jesus responded to their amazement by stroking his beard, furrowing his brow, and then passionately asking in his best counselor voice, "Tell me about it." And that's just what they did. For the next few miles, they poured out everything they knew, how they had loved him and had pinned their hopes on him, but how his death on the cross had put an end to everything. Jesus responded by giving them what may have been the world's very first Sunday school lesson, reminding them of the scriptures and how their friend had fulfilled so many of the things that those scriptures had promised. Yet even with all of that, they still did not recognize him. Well, it was early evening by the time they finally reached Emmaus. Cleopas and his wife stopped, ready to enter the house and eat. Luke wrote that Jesus walked ahead as if he were going on. Jesus had obviously listened to his mother and knew that it was very bad manners to invite oneself to dinner. Cleopas and his companion, his wife, must have also listened to their mothers, not to mention their rabbis, and knew that it was very bad manners not to extend hospitality and feed a stranger. So they invited him in, or more than likely, she invited him in. Even back then, you see, husbands knew better than to invite someone to dinner. Well, when the meal was finally ready, they all sat down and Jesus was asked to say grace. Luke wrote that when he took, blessed, and broke the bread, The eyes of Cleopas and his wife were open, and they instantly recognized Jesus. He was known to them in the breaking of the bread, Luke explained. At that dinner table, heaven and earth seemed to touch, and it became a thin place for those two disciples. Now, there are many things that are very remarkable about that story. There are subtle references, for example, to the story of Abraham's meal with those three strangers and to a very, very early version of Christian preaching. There are also not so subtle stand up and slap you in the face references to the feeding of the 5,000 and the Last Supper. But what is most remarkable about that story, I think, is the very unremarkable way in which Jesus was finally recognized. Please note that it wasn't through some burning bush that those two disciples were finally able to see him. Please also note that it wasn't through the parting of the sea or a walking on the waves that he was seen. The eyes of those two were not open because Jesus had turned a loaf of bread into 12 baskets of leftovers or a pitcher of water into a very fine Merlot. Nothing remarkable or supernatural precipitated their recognition. There were no bells and whistles in that Emmaus home. All Jesus did was to sit down and eat with Cleopas and his wife. As they gathered around that dinner table for a meal, something they had done thousands of times before, heaven and earth touched. For it was during that meal that their eyes were opened and they recognized their risen Lord. As they gathered around that dinner table, Luke wrote that he was known to them in the breaking of the bread. Can it be the same for you and for me? Can our family dinner table become a thin place? Let's forget about all the religious stuff for a few moments and concentrate on how even the social sciences are beginning to understand how special the family dinner table can be. And to make sure that all of you pay attention now and not just a couple of these folks in the front row who have little kids, please know that these studies show that all of this data is just as valid for families with children and great-grandchildren for grandchildren and great-grandchildren as they are for families with children. Studies are now showing that the more a family eats together, the less likely its kids are to smoke, to drink, to do drugs, to get depressed, to develop eating disorders, and to consider suicide. And the more likely they are to do well in school, to delay having sex, to eat their vegetables, to learn big words, and to know which fork to use. A recent article in the respected journal Pediatrics reports that there is a clear connection between shared family meals and better health and eating habits. And a study by the National Center for Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University found that the older children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren get, the more they need that time around the family dinner table. Mid and senior high students who eat a regular meal with their parents or grandparents are 40% more likely to go to college than those who don't. Robin Fox is an anthropologist at Rutgers University. If it was just about food, she writes about the family dinner table, we could squirt it into our children's mouth with a tube. Even the social sciences understand the importance of eating together. Those of us who call ourselves Christian should have another reason to understand the importance of eating together. Every one of us should remember how eating together plays a vital role in the story of faith. Even a quick reading of the Bible will tell you that meals play a significant role in the story of salvation. The Father's blessing was passed to Jacob during a family meal. The children of Israel celebrated their liberation from Egypt with a Passover meal. Life in the barren wilderness was sustained with food that came down each day from above. Jesus' first miracle was to turn water into wine at a Cana wedding feast. There are stories about Jesus providing a meal to multitudes of people with just a couple loaves of bread and a few fish. Of sitting at the dinner table with tax collectors, sinners, and a wee little man named Zacchaeus. And of having a last supper with his disciples. If you read the second chapter of the book of Acts, you will see how eating together was one of the defining marks of the early Christian church. Peter had a dream about a meal and who was able to sit at the table that transformed the way that the gospel was preached. Eating meals together has always been a defining mark of biblical people. The dinner table has become a thin place to so many. I don't believe that Jesus being recognized as good friends sat around the table was any accident. Jesus had always been known to them in the breaking of the bread. I want to share a story with you. It was Christmas Eve. 3 months earlier, my wife had told me that she no longer wanted to be married to me. My boys were spending Christmas with their grandmother, and I was all alone. As I stood in the pulpit that night and told the story of the first Christmas, I looked out on a congregation filled with families. Parents were hugging little children that had visions of sugar plums dancing in their heads. Husbands and wives were sitting close and closer than usual and holding hands. And I tried my best to smile as I told them of the good tidings of great joy for all the people. I don't think I had ever been so miserable. After the service, I was standing at the door and wishing everyone a Merry Christmas. And my good friend Paulsetta walked up to me. Paul was a character. A good Italian like me, and there's really no other kind. He took a certain pride in being very, very politically incorrect. His overconfidence was sometime annoying, but he was my paisano, my goombadi. He had the biggest heart you have ever seen. When it was time to shake my hand, he just looked at me and said, "You're having dinner at my house tonight." I protested as I had plans to simply go home to my empty parsonage, heat up a hot pocket in the microwave, and sulk my way through the night. Paul, however, would not take no for an answer. He said he had already told his wife Ruth Ann and his kids that I was coming and that their Christmas Eve would be ruined if I didn't show up. Now Carol will tell you that it was totally useless to try and argue with Paul. So grudgingly, I went with him. Once at his house, I watched as John and Ann each got to open one of their presents on Christmas Eve. I listened to all of Paul's stories about Christmases past and what John and Ann used to do when they were little kids. When it was dinner time, we all gathered around the table. John and Ann, one on either side of me, took my hands and we began to pray. I don't know how to explain what happened next, other than the fact that Paul's table began to look very, very different. Heaven and earth seemed to touch. The risen Christ was moving among us. I looked up and Paul's family had suddenly become my family. Around that table, I discovered a fin place. While I still didn't enjoy going home to my empty parsonage, and even though I really missed my boys, I did find something that had been lacking that night. For in sitting around Paul's table and eating together, Christ became known to me in the breaking of bread. That Christmas was never the same. Is your family table a thin place? Have you experienced the risen Christ in the breaking of the bread? The Celts have reminded us that thin places happen whenever the boundary between heaven and earth becomes particularly soft, porous, and permeable. When one discovers a thin place, they are reminded that God is not up there or someplace else, but right here. Thin places, you see, are those moments in life when the veil is suddenly lifted and we recognize God. This morning's lesson from Luke reminds us that at a common, ordinary dinner table in this little bitty town known as Emmaus in this very dusty part of Palestine, there was a thin place for those two broken-hearted disciples. And the good news of this story is that if it can happen at that table, it can happen at your table as well. Anytime we gather around the table and eat with those we love, you see, that table can become a thin place. For those of you who have had the opportunity to be mothers, and for anyone else who has ever been a member of a family, raise your hand if you've ever been a member of a family. I thought so. I can't think of a better message on this day that we celebrate the Christian home than this, for he is known to us in the breaking of the bread. And let us pray. Help us to understand, O Lord, how our dinner table can become a thin place. Amen.